I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Cohen.
Who are you?
Bond, James Bond.
Good morning. My name's Bond. James Bond.
Bond. James Bond.
My name is Bond. James Bond.
Bond. James Bond.
That music and that phrase need no introduction. The 21st James Bond movie, Casino Royale, opens today and, according to the reviewers, Daniel Craig is a different kind of 007, darker, less cultured. For instance, when asked if he wants his martini shaken or stirred, he replies, "Do I look like I give a damn?" Casino Royale was Ian Fleming's first novel, published in 1953. Fleming's other novels were made into popular movies, but in recent years they have become increasingly silly, predictable, and strangely out of step with the times. This new movie is trying to appeal to a new audience. Today on Radio Times, we want to explore the James Bond phenomenon over the years. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We've invited J.D. Connor to be our guest in this hour. He's a professor of film and literature at Harvard University. He saw the James Bond filmed earlier this week. And J.D. Connor, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Good morning. It's good to be back.
Well, so what's your critique of Casino Royale?
Well, I think it did exactly what they wanted to do. I expect it to do incredibly well at the box office. It seems that it's coming out at exactly the right time in the fall, but also the things they wanted to get Daniel Craig to do, he does tremendously well. He's much more active than Pierce Brosnan. He looks coiled and taut. He looks fantastic when he's got his clothes off, but he looks much more dangerous than the recent Bonds have looked. And I think that that's going to appeal to not only the traditional Bond audience, which is aging, as it always is, but will bring in many younger people. It'll set records, I'm sure, in Great Britain, and it'll probably do very well here in the U.S., even with something like Happy Feet opening against it.
Well, and I do want to pick up on that, but you know, we have a really weird phone line, and I'm going to see if we can try to get a better phone line. I'm getting a lot of feedback even from myself. Let me just quickly reintroduce our guest and also see if we can get a better phone line and also open up the lines to our listeners at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And from time to time on Radio Times, we like to take a look at pop culture. We spend a lot of times talking about serious subjects, which we want to do, but we also want to take some time from time to time to take a look at pop culture, and things like James Bond fit very neatly into that. J.D. Connor, professor of film and literature at Harvard University. And J.D., let's see if we have a better phone line here.
I hope we do.
I hope we do, too, and I think that does sound a lot better. As you said, this new James Bond asked to do something, I guess, different from the previous kinds of James Bond. Certainly looking at him, he looks very different. For one, he's blonde, but for the other, he has this extraordinary physique.
Yeah, he's remarkably well cut. at a certain point, right when they're getting ready to torture him, Le Chiffre, the bad guy, has him sort of strapped naked to a chair and admiringly says, "You know, you've taken great care of your body. What a pity." But his reaction is sort of everyone's reaction at that moment, that it is going to be a pity to watch this body undergo torture.
Well, and Carrie Rickey had an interesting comment in the Philadelphia Inquirer yesterday in her review of Casino Royale. She says, "Craig is not your father's James Bond, but he's almost certainly your daughter's."
Well, there is a sense that that in order to make James Bond appealing to a female audience, which has been That's been sort of the ace in the hole of the series, that it was an action genre that men and women went to nearly equally. Mm-hmm. You would need to make you would need to find a Bond who would be attractive to women in of a different generation, and certainly this much more muscular, coiled body is a big part of that. Another big part of that, though, is moving away from the sort of highly, even over-sophisticated Bonds that we've just come out of, and trying to find somebody whose story about how you become James Bond would be attractive to men and women.
And some reviewers have described him almost like a thug. Would you agree?
Well, he looks... certainly he looks like he's rough around the edges. Is he thuggish? No, I think that... he's just... I think that if you look at sort of what the older reviewers think, he might seem thuggish compared, certainly compared to Pierce Brosnan. But that among a younger audience, this body is not a thug's body. It's just the body of somebody who takes care. And that's what makes him attractive to this younger audience. They particularly want to make sure they get.
And I'm assuming this younger audience is, what, 20s, 30s, that probably would look at some of these films from the 60s and 70s and 80s and just think that they're sort of like a piece of ancient history.
Well, even younger than that. The film is rated PG-13. They've done everything they can do up to that PG-13 line, but they're going to keep it so that everyone can go. One thing that is surprising about the Bond franchise is that it was a remarkably successful series of video games, beginning with GoldenEye. And at that point, that was the moment when, in the United States at least, video game sales outstripped box office. So if you can hold teenage boys and convince them to go see this film, you've really maximized its potential. But also it means that you can stay relevant much longer. They're really certain that people over 25, and sadly the under and over 25 line is the key line in Hollywood, that people over 25 are interested in this film. But people under, it's a dicey problem to try to keep them interested in a franchise that they know, you know, granddad liked and that mom likes and so on.
Yeah, you know what, we're going to try to fix your phone again. We're getting some weird kind of feedback, and I apologize to our guest and to our audience about that. For whatever reason, we've got some little mice in the phone line here. But just quickly, that's J.D. Connor, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, and we're taking a look at the James Bond franchise legacy. And J.D. Connor is a professor of film and literature at Harvard University. If you've been sleeping under a rock, then you may not know, but you should know that the 21st James Bond movie opened today. It's called Casino Royale, and it features a new kind of James Bond. He's played by Daniel Craig, and you may remember him from Road to Perdition and Munich. It's a different kind of James Bond, darker, less cultured. It's interesting that this film, Casino Royale, was Ian Fleming's first novel, published back in 1953, of course, the height of the Cold War. It was made into a spoof film in 1967. In fact, it had Peter Sellers playing James Bond, 007, Ursula Andress. Woody Allen was in the original movie version of Casino Royale. But clearly, Hollywood decided to bring back this franchise and try to speak to a much younger audience. And that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times. And it's interesting that these movies have survived for some 40 years. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And while we get our guests to a different and hopefully better phone, let's hear from our listeners. And if you have a favorite Bond, whether it's Sean Connery, George Lazenby, Timothy Dalton, Roger Moore, Pierce Brosnan, give us a call here, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let's get Don from Allentown to join us. Don, go ahead. Your Radio Times.
Good afternoon.
Or good morning.
I was curious. Good morning.
Yeah, morning.
The film Never Say Never, John Connery's last Bond film, it seems like, is it just me or is that the Thunderball plot recycled? And when you look at all the textbooks that go through the Bond history, they seem to leave that one out for some reason. Is there any particular reason for that?
Well, I am not your Bond expert, but I'm asking you, Don, was Sean Connery your James Bond as far as you were concerned?
Oh, by far.
And why is that? I mean, I have to say, because I grew up with this stuff, that he was always my James Bond. But this Daniel Craig looks good to me.
Yeah, and I haven't seen the new one, but he just had the right mix of roughness, poise, and all that. I mean, just it seemed he had the whole package. He wasn't outlandish. He was, he was fallible in certain ways, and just more human. But just had that. He always had that ability to pull it out at the last minute and do it and win. So it just, I don't know. It just. It was just because Sean Connery was a good actor. I don't know.
Yeah, that certainly helps. And Don, thanks for calling into Radio Times.
Thank you.
Let me see if I can get our guest back on a better phone. J.D. Connor, are you with us?
Yeah, I am. I hope that this phone is
better.
Well,
I do too. I'm not sure exactly what's what the problem is, but we will persevere. What do you think about Sean Connery as 007?
Well, I think for me he was the best of the previous Bonds as well. I'd agree. One of the things that separates him from Daniel Craig is that Sean Connery certainly had a profile that meant that as a character, the star image around him was already in line with the James Bond star. He was dangerous, and yet he was smart, and all of these things. With Daniel Craig, he's operated much more as a kind of actor who disappears into his roles. And so what they've done in this film in order to make it possible to see him as both dangerous and suave, depending on the situation, is to give him a backstory, to actually tell the Bond story. They do it with some rather cute dialogue between him and his love interest, Vesper Lynd. And in that way, they can make up in story what we're missing in terms of character when we just sort of walk in. I don't know how many Americans have kept up with the Daniel Craig career. He tends to end up in sort of character roles, like in the movie Munich.
That's right.
But sometimes, but when he's been a leading actor, it's been in smaller British productions generally, and so he doesn't need to be sold in Britain, but he certainly did here, and that's one of the things they did in this film.
Well, and I'm looking at the other 007s, George Lazenby, Timothy Dalton, Roger Moore, Pierce Brosnan. From your perspective, J.D., who after Sean Connery was a good enough James Bond?
Well, I think after Sean Connery, you sort of pick and choose particular films for when they're good. For instance, I think Pierce Brosnan in the opening parts of The World Is Not Enough is a much more dangerous Pierce Brosnan than people had expected him to be. He's much more interesting that way. He's much closer to the guy who appeared in The Matador. So in that sense, even an actor who seems to be sort of on the edges of toughness, if he's even there, can be made that way depending on the film. I really think that Timothy Dalton tried to do this with the character as well, but after Connery, I think it's performance by performance.
And I'll tell you what, we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our guests and back to our conversation talking about the James Bond phenomenon. J.D. Connor is a professor of film and literature at Harvard University. We're going to take a very short break and then talk more and also take some more of your phone calls. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Give us a call. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The University of Pennsylvania supports WHYY. Have you been treated for bipolar disorder or experienced a manic or mixed episode? If so, you may be eligible to participate in Penn's clinical study of an investigational medication for bipolar disorder. To learn more, 215-573-8582. Eligible participants may receive study-related medication, lab work, and evaluations. 215-573-8582. The University of Pennsylvania supports WHYY.
I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next Do You Bet Your Garden, we'll offer support and advice to all of you, quote, black thumbs who hold back on growing because everyone else seems to do it so much better. Plus chemical-free answers to an especially large selection of your garden questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY 91 FM.
On the next Fresh Air, the real mafia. Selwyn Rabb is author of Five Families, The Rise, Decline, and Resurgence of America's Most Powerful Mafia Empires. It's a history of the mob, from its roots in Sicily through the downfall of John Gotti to its resurgence after September 11th. It's now out in paperback. I'm Dave Davies. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
Gold finger, he's the man with the Midas touch, a spider's touch, such a cold finger beckons you to enter his web. You feel, for a golden girl knows when he's kissed her, it's the kiss of death from Mr. Goldfinger.
Shirley Bassey singing Goldfinger, and today on Radio Times we are talking about James Bond and J.D. Connor, our guest professor of film and literature at Harvard University. And J.D., I have to say, I love her version of Goldfinger, and I love the brass and the violins. I mean, for me, it's a completely nostalgic experience.
No, it's got the sweep that immediately says James Bond to everybody. Yeah.
And it's interesting that there's always been a piece of music associated with one of these new James Bond films.
Well, they've always made sure that this was one of the very smart things they did from the beginning was they knew that they could make a bunch of money selling records on the side. And once that became part and parcel of the James Bond experience, then they could drive publicity interest in the films even before they came out. Well, who got signed to do the new James Bond film? For a while, they kind of fell apart with that. It ended up not as good. You know, sometimes it was something like the Duran Duran "View to a Kill" song and so on. But they, with this film, they made a real effort to go back and do what worked right previously. So they got Chris Cornell to do this song, "You Know My Name," during an opening credit sequence that's really gorgeous. It's a terrifically colorful, nifty, fractal card-playing thing that you know, certainly makes the movie worth it.
Why do you think, though, J.D., let's go back to the 1950s when Ian Fleming began writing these James Bond novels.
Mm-hmm.
What was he reflecting? What was he responding to?
Well, at the heart of it, I guess, is a certain crisis in masculinity. From the very beginning, he was terrified, I guess, of getting married. He was finally getting married in his 40s, and before settling down, he decided to write a novel in which somebody would get away with all kinds of rakish behavior on the side and would lead the exciting life that Fleming had led during the war, but that he was no longer leading. And in that sense, Fleming is just a tiny version of what's going on broadly in the culture throughout the 50s and into the 60s. What kind of man can make a difference in a Cold War world where it seems like these decisions are made at a scale not of the individual spy, but at the scale of, you know, giant bureaucracies facing off? In the novel version of Casino Royale, James Bond continuously chastises himself in the latter parts for playing Red Indians, a silly game that's a sidelight to the real Cold War. And like many Cold Warriors, Fleming and Bond and so on, look with admiration on the sort of ruthless, asexual, bureaucratic smirch the USSR's intelligence operations. So at the base of it, it's that kind of worry that somehow the man of derring do is no longer needed in this new world, and what what kind of world could make him relevant again? How can we possibly salvage this?
Well, that's a fascinating description, giving the Cold War this sort of backdrop for this masculine crisis of identity.
Well, that I think is, you know, that seems to be what's at stake in the novels when, you know, at the very end of the first one, when Bond has sort of realized that his little card game was nothing, he talks about the guys in Smersh as the real enemy who had been working quietly, coldly, without heroics. And on the one hand, that's admirable. They can work quietly and coldly. On the other hand, he's terrified that, you know, there aren't any heroes anymore. Mm-hmm. And some of the sort of byplay between the Cold War and the sexuality that's the heart of the Bond attraction shows up in his seduction scene, I guess, you would call it, of Vesper Lynd in the novel as well. He calls her, they struggle a great deal. And once he realizes, it says here that she was profoundly, excitingly sensual. He knew that the conquest of her body each time would have the sweet tang of rape.
Wow.
That's the kind of harsh, masculine figure that Fleming is trying to craft here at a particularly conflicted time in his own life. And then, obviously, 1954, 1955, into the 60s, this is not smooth sailing for the British Empire or for the North Atlantic Treaty Organization as they stare down the Russians.
Well, this is not then the PG sexuality of the 1950s that people often talk about.
No, it's not. The high camp sexual escapades that start to creep into the Bond in the 60s and that then really dominate in the Roger Moore era aren't part of the early Bond novels at all. It's a much more straightforward masculinist sex. There's a reason why Kingsley Amis liked this stuff and decided to go write one himself. They could identify with this this character as the kind of spy version of that besieged British man of letters that he and Larkin and authors we think of as far more reputable we're dealing with in other forms.
Does that explain why the Queen, you think, went to the opening of Casino Royale earlier this week?
Well, actually, it's one of the other things that's always at stake in the James Bond novels and then in the films is the question of the relevance of Britain after the Empire. The Cold War is really a post-imperial period for them as well. Fleming settled down into the Bahamas. Most of the location shooting for this film took place in the Bahamas. The rest of it was all done in Prague. And so these little places that somehow are still very British, even in a world where the Americans control everything and have all the money at their disposal that they could need, that feeling of Britishness and the British Empire, even the fag ends of it, is really at the heart of the James Bond sequence.
And that's J.D. Connor, our guest today on Radio Times, as we talk about the James Bond franchise and legacy. He's a professor of film and literature at Harvard University, and as I'm sure you're very well aware, the new James Bond film, Casino Royale, opens today. It's gotten pretty good reviews, and many of the reviewers appreciate Daniel Craig as a different kind of 007. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. If you've been a reader of some of these Ian Fleming novels and watched some of the films, we want to hear some of your thoughts. Let's get Robin from Yardley to join us. Robin, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I haven't seen the movie, of course, but you described it as going back to the origins of Bond, and that was very interesting to me. But I also was thinking that Batman Begins also followed that pattern and was very successful. And I'm wondering if specifically this Bond movie fits into a class of American movies, the Westerns, and maybe, I guess, Japanese movies as well, and Japanese stories about action figures who have these psychological stories to tell as well.
Huh.
Is there a class of movie like that in American film, and does this movie fit into that?
That's an interesting question. Robin, thanks for calling in. J.D. Connor, what do you think?
I think that that's very perceptive. I think that's right. There's something at stake in the origin story that allows it to be reimagined in a way that lifts some of the burden. If somebody came up to you and said, as a screenwriter, now you've got to write the 21st James Bond movie, you'd be paralyzed, maybe, or you would end up writing a kind of vague pastiche of the previous ones. But if someone came up to you and said, we want to reimagine this from the beginning, now the slate is wiped a little cleaner. Mm. You can still make your jokes about the other James Bond films, the not giving a damn about whether it's shaken or stirred, and so on. But you have much more license. You get your own license, I guess, as a screenwriter. And the same thing would be true for actors and directors, that this is a way of getting rid of some of the dead hand of the past. So there's a talent reason to do it this way. But this story of origins, it also serves to help deal with some of the narrative problems that people have these days. If in the 60s and 70s it was obvious that we were fighting a bunch of Cold War films, then it's also obvious that we don't know what we should be fighting right now, what kinds of films we should be making. So we can start it over and, in this case, maybe make a bunch of anti-terrorist films and try to generate a new enemy that will serve us well narratively.
And it's interesting that the previous movie version of Casino Royale really was a spoof.
It was. The story behind that version, produced by Charles Feldman and then starring everybody from Peter Sellers and Woody Allen to Orson Welles and Ursula Andress, is a really crazy, convoluted story. The rights to that one novel had been sold independently back in the 50s. Fleming had sold it to American Television, and there actually is a TV version of Bond from 1954. He's an American character, played by Barry Nelson.
Really?
But the setup is basically the same. He has to defeat this guy at cards in order to render him penniless. So this novel is existing out there on its own. It can be bought and sold independently. It does get bought, and Charles Feldman tried to get Sean Connery interested in starring in a kind of alternative Bond franchise, and Connery wanted $1 million, I guess. And Feldman said, no, we'll do it this other crazy way, which was going to involve a lot of pseudo-psychedelic nonsense. And so they made this spoof in 67 with everybody. And, it was an incredibly expensive movie. I think it's a horrible movie, but
doesn't work
it was
as a
out
spoof.
There.
Let me get to Ken from Lansdale to join us. Hi, Ken. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Yeah, I'm a Bond aficionado myself.
Good.
And I haven't seen Casino Royale yet, but I'm looking forward to it. My impression of Daniel Craig, I saw him in Layer Cake, he struck me as kind of a British Steve McQueen.
That's a very interesting observation. Let me see what J.D. Connor says.
I think that's certainly part of it. He has an interiority, a certain quietness about him that can come off, I suppose, if he were to give a bad performance, as a kind of stoniness. But in this case, you get the sense that you get sometimes from McQueen or previously from Gregory Peck, of somebody who's worked very, very hard to keep a certain false front of of equanimity out there. This is a Bond that's much closer to, I don't know, I hate to say it, the George Lazenby Bond of On Her Majesty's Secret Service, the one who falls in love, the one who is betrayed, the one who's vulnerable underneath all that muscle and toughness.
And I'd like to answer that question to the gentleman before posed about Never Say Never Again. He wondered about why that's not concluded in the franchise. It actually is a remake of Thunderball, but it's not part of the franchise. It was done by a completely different production company.
Well, I appreciate that, Ken. And do you have a favorite James Bond as an aficionado?
I guess Very Close Call, number one Goldfinger, and number two From Russia with Love. For me, that's really the 60s Bond films. From Roger Moore on, they were never as good as they were before that.
Yeah.
And that's, I'm kind of the purist in that sense.
Fair enough. Ken, thanks for calling into Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
Sure.
I think that's right. And we've been blaming Roger Moore for a lot of this, but I'd like to also try to blame the Cold War a little bit, too. in the 60s, with the hot Cold War that Kennedy oversees, we get the sense that Bond, by being cool in the face of all of this, or by being snarky at times, has managed to get himself out of a remarkably difficult predicament. But the 70s are largely a detente era, and so being smarmy just comes across as being slightly effete. It doesn't take any machismo to make fun of Leonid Brezhnev, but if you're making fun of Khrushchev, that takes some guts, I think.
A different kind of target.
That's right.
And a different kind of enemy. And it is interesting to look at the various characters who have been the bad guys, or in some cases the bad women in these Bond films. Do you think there's one that's more effective than the other?
Well, this one is much more sedate. One of the things that's interesting about this novel and then the film versions of it is that Bond thinks that he's playing for very high stakes against somebody who really matters. But in the end, this is a guy who can be dispatched by an organization that's more powerful or more extensive than his own. In order to boost the credibility of this bad guy, they actually make him much more of a terrorist mastermind than certainly any of the previous versions of it hinted he was. But he's an intriguing guy. You know, the chief, he's the cipher. That's what that means. In the TV version, he was played by Peter Lorre. If you can keep Peter Lorre's mug in your mind as you watch this film, it'd be a shocking thing to imagine the two of them playing the same character. So, I find him rather interesting. He gives some excellently bad monologues during the torture scene and so on, and he's gutless in all the right ways.
This does involve a card game, as to be expected. But I wonder whether, with all the online poker playing, did that in any way change the way this card game is presented in the new James Bond?
Well, the fact that it's poker is the change.
Instead
it was
baccarat
in all the other versions, but now. You know, it's hard to imagine a real man being a baccarat hand. Instead, he's got to be a poker hand. And I think that in part that's a concession to American tastes. But I think it's also the sense that we now get the feeling that lots of characters gather around the poker table from watching, poker on ESPN or whatever.
And I don't think I'm giving too much away to say that there's no money penny in this James Bond. Is that right, J.D.?
No, there isn't. There's a little joke about that, though. When he first meets Vesper Lynd on the train, they have a meet-cute, as Hollywood demands, and she is the representative of the Treasury. She says, "I'm the money," and he says, "Worth every penny," and it just slides right by.
That's a real in-joke, right?
It's a real in-joke. There's another version of that with her as well when... they're riding in the car and they're discussing their cover stories, and he is looking in the secret folder and he explains that her name is going to be Stephanie Broadchest, and she can't believe that that's going to be her name, and he hides the folder from her. So all of the goofy, punning Bond girl names are out of this. Her name is just Vesper Lynd.
Right, which makes sense for today's audience, right, and today's sensibilities?
It does make sense, but it's also entirely accurate. It's also entirely faithful to the novel.
Interesting. Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about James Bond, the franchise, the legacy. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We especially want to hear from the Bond aficionados in our audience, and J.D. Connor, our guest. He's a professor of film and literature at Harvard University. Much more after this short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
A man, his dream, a legacy of care for children. The Nemours Alfred I. DuPont Hospital for Children supports WHYY. Alfred I. DuPont's commitment toward improving the lives of children, now and for generations to come, is fulfilled in the DuPont Hospital and major children's specialty centers in Delaware, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey. More information about the DuPont Hospital is available online at nemours.org. That's NEMOURS.org.
Next time on Day to Day.
Attention, Thomas Dolby. Someone is looking for you.
Remember that Donald Duck video you borrowed to sample 20 years ago?
Well, David Waz and his son would like it back.
I phoned again and again and never to hear back from him.
A music producer blinded by a smooth-talking singer.
Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. A Philadelphia mother remembers her late son who learned to forgive the people who shot him. Also, neoconservatives have been bruised by the war in Iraq, but at least one now says the U.S. should bomb Iran. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
To say, live and let live.
You know you did, you know you did, you know you did.
But if this ever-changing world in which we live in makes you give in and cry, say, live and let die.
That, of course, is Paul McCartney, Live and Let Die, one of the theme songs in the James Bond series. And we're talking about the James Bond phenomenon today on Radio Times with J.D. Connor. He's a professor of film and literature at Harvard University. Let's get back to our callers. And we've got Tad from Mount Laurel, New Jersey. Tad, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I heard a story once that Ian Fleming visited Gwynedd Mercy College back, way back, and that James Bond was actually the name of an ornithologist that was doing work there. Is that true, and that's where he got the name?
J.D. Connor?
I don't know the visit part of that story, but yeah, James Bond was the author of a bird book, and Fleming said that he picked it because it was such a boring, banal sort of name that could be used as the cover for a secret agent. As a result of that, and Fleming was really interested in birds, like the British men of his generation tended to be.
And Tad, would you say Gwynedd Mercy outside of Philadelphia?
College? James Bond's from Philly.
Oh, James Bond, the ornithologist, is from Philly.
Well, there we go.
There you go. Thank you for calling into Radio Times. Was Ian Fleming a snob, JD?
Yeah, sure. I think that there's no way. One of the things that his snobbery does, though, is that it distinguishes the novels a little bit. He was a snob in that he knew the right place to buy everything that one needed to buy, where to get your tobacco made, where to get your shirts made, and those details show up in the Bond novels. They were some of the first novels to be really permeated by products. At the beginning, by brand names. Now, they weren't necessarily brand names that everybody knew. They were brand names that proved that you belonged in a certain upper-class British society. But now, those brand names then made those novels and then the films really amenable to product placement. And we know from the Bond series of late that, you know, not just the Aston Martin, but the watches that he wears and the clothes that he wears and the places that he goes, and in this one, the boat that he is on, all of these are products, expensive products that are placed on purpose in the films.
And Hollywood loves that, doesn't it? I mean, that's one of their ways they make money, isn't it?
That's right. And in this case, it's the Broccoli family, the production company, that controls all of that. And it means that, you know, really, no matter how much a Bond film costs to make, before it hits the screen, it's paid for a lot of itself.
Wow.
That's a way of taking a very risky job and making it much easier to deal with.
And in this movie, you're talking about the Aston Martin DB5, right?
The DBS.
Or the DBS, I should
yeah.
say.
James Bond arrives in the Bahamas, and we see him driving around in a new Ford. Ford is the parent company of Aston Martin. Mm-hmm. And first he wins an antique Aston Martin, and then eventually he gets access to the prototype when he gets to Montenegro. It's a It's a lovely car.
Indeed, I've heard. And watches figure big in James Bond as well, right? Omega watches are on product placement.
They've gone through a whole bunch of different watch sponsors. My issue of Vanity Fair this time came with a supplement just about Hollywood and watches. And there was a long article featuring all the James Bond watches over time. I hadn't realized, not being in the, the five-figure watch buying community, exactly all the crazy stuff that he's worn.
Well, this is a sidebar, but just open the New York Times and every page is a huge watch ad. Let me ask you a little bit about Q, because Q, of course, was the person that introduced all these new gadgets to James Bond, and these gadgets have been so much a part of these movies. But Q's kind of disappeared as well, too.
Right. Q's not around. This is pretty much a gadget-free film. I mean, the car has, some useful stuff in it, but nothing that seems impossible. It's got, I don't want to, because these are now sort of later in the movie things, I don't want to spoil them,
right.
But, it's not like the front of the car drops down and it fires, some sort of death ray weapon or anything like that. It's the kind of stuff that, you could put in a glove box. And in that way, they get us back to paying less attention to technology, which is dehumanizing in the Bond film's eyes, and more attention to people and strategy and bodies and things like that.
Well, let's get back to our callers. Just a couple open lines as we talk about James Bond through the ages. And that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Any questions, comments, observations, do give us a call. J.D. Connor is our guest. He's a professor of film and literature at Harvard University. Earlier this week, he saw the new James Bond film, Casino Royale, and it opens today in theaters across the country. Let me get Andre from Georgia to join us. Andre, go ahead, your radio times.
Yes, is it true that when James Bond opened with the line, shaking that stirred, he has a lifetime supply of gin from Bombay? And number two, about the killer, his clothes, he was always impeccably dressed in the movie.
Let me take your questions, Andre, and thanks for calling into Radio Times. Do you know about the martini kickback, J.D. Connor?
I don't know about the martini kickback, actually. I do know that the drink that he first invents in this film is not a plain vodka martini. It's a weird concoction of Gordon's and vodka and lemon peel,
right,
that he eventually names after his girlfriend. But the clothing, that was something that Fleming was insistent upon from the very beginning. He always dropped the names of various important tailors in the novels, and he wanted people to be dressed very well. And in the film, there's a nice back and forth between Bond and his girlfriend Vesper over who needs to make a better looking entrance into the casino. And he really does wear a lovely, lovely dinner jacket.
And the martini thing, I think is just, I think this film is saying a lot when the new James Bond says, when asked whether he wants his martini shaken or stirred, he says, "Do I look like I give a damn?"
And he does not at that moment. It's very nice.
Andre, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let me get Lou from Orlando, Florida to join us. Lou, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, great show. I think this is one of the best movie serials ever done. And, I'm the demographic late 40s where, as a young kid, James Bond was my idol. We all wanted to be like him, have the women, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And just still, to me, Sean Connery's the best Bond. And the best Bond movie I thought was Russia with Love, because it had a mix of a little bit of technological, cool stuff, but it was mostly a story. And I wonder if this movie will stack up against Russia with Love and Sean Connery. Thanks.
And Lou, one of our earlier callers also said they thought To Russia with Love was the best. J.D., do you want to comment on that?
Well, to my mind, it's one of the better ones as well. I really like it. For keeping the focus on the Cold War mechanics of the Bond at that time, it's also one of the leaner Bond films with fewer sort of sidelight kinds of things. This film, I think it will come close. Part of the problem with adapting this novel and trying to stay faithful and tell the origin story is that they had to, in effect, add long set pieces. There's a really remarkable long set piece chase at the beginning. There's a scene at the Miami airport, a sequence at the Miami airport that's pretty dicey to pull off. And these can feel like, why are they here right now moments. I didn't find them that way, but I have the feeling that over time, it's the kind of thing that can sort of wear away some of the novelty of the film because these aren't that tightly integrated into the plot, which is much more loosey-goosey than it wants to be.
Oh, interesting. Lou, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And these Bond films had a tradition of always having that opening sequence, essentially, can you top this, right?
Well, and this time, the opening sequence, I think, is just, there's a chase after the credits, but the opening sequence, I think, is just about perfect for what they wanted to do.
Huh.
It intercuts two different places. It shows you Bond at his most sophisticated and at his most brutal. It's all done in black and white. It shows you two different Bonds, and it shows you how he becomes 00. He's got to get his two kills, and we get to see them both. I thought between that and then the remarkable credit sequence, this was certainly on the right track. And then any problems I had after that, I was willing to forgive.
Do you think it's a PG-13 movie, or do you think it's a little more violent than that? I haven't seen it, obviously, but some have talked about a torture scene and even just what you described.
It, like I said, it's right up to the edge of PG-13. They do a nice job of being decorous and cutting away from stuff that's going to go on right outside the frame.
Mm-hmm.
I saw it with Dan Kimmel, a critic up here in Boston, and before we saw the film unroll, he said, the thing this series needs to do is to just go rated R. And they clearly sense that this series needs to be grittier than it had been, and but they didn't want to put any age restriction on it. I'm sure they would have done whatever it took to get back to PG-13.
Would you bring, though, a 13-year-old to it?
A 13-year-old? Yeah, I'd bring a 13-year-old to it. Yeah.
Let me get to Bob from Florida. You know, it's interesting, we have mostly men callers, but I guess we shouldn't be surprised about that. Let's get Bob from Florida Keys to join us. Bob, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I was a camera operator on the chase sequence through the construction site that was shot in the Bahamas earlier this year.
Oh, that's great. Are you you're a cameraman yourself, Bob?
That's right.
For hire?
Yes, yes.
And where did you film that? In the Keys or Bahamas or where?
No, we shot that in the Bahamas. There is a construction site, a hotel that was under construction. They stopped construction 45 years ago, and the place is, you know, just kind of half done. And so the production company said, wow, this is a great place for a chase sequence. And then they brought in tons and tons of I-beams and steel and made this huge open framework and brought in construction cranes. All of it was brought from England. And that's where we shot the scene, on the south shore of New Providence Island.
Wow. And I haven't seen it. I know J.D. has. But was that a challenge to film this particular sequence, Bob?
Yeah, I never had so much fun in all my life. It was really a lot of fun. A lot of high work. Oftentimes cameras were over 100 feet in the air, and the obligatory, the helicopter stuff, and we blew things up, which is always fun.
Well, hold on, Bob. Let me get to J.D. Connor, because you've seen the film, J.D. Does this? I think you referenced this sequence earlier. It's a good sequence?
Oh, it's terrific. Yeah, it's the basis of it is not really the pyrotechnics. It's the free running that they do. The guy who Bond is chasing is the guy who invented that sport of free running, where you run through a city and, you know, in effect jump from balcony to street level or jump down cascades of stairs and so forth. And as they start to move through this construction site, it provides a lot of really nice jumping opportunities, almost like Donkey Kong, between levels and cranes and so on. And you can see all the work there on the screen. It's really nice. One of the things that I liked especially about that sequence is that these days, sometimes sequences like that get shot too fast. I have nothing against super fast sequences, but that is, the shots are edited together too quickly. And in this one, there's a little more time to let it play out, and you can watch somebody's facial expression sort of through an impact and then beyond that. And I think that made it more effective.
Bob, thanks for calling into Radio Times.
Thank you.
And let's get one more caller. We've got Ron from Paulsboro joining us. Ron, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi there.
Yes, I had heard a rumor that Ian Fleming had been at earlier in the 50s, I believe, was at some kind of reception with some CIA people. And he jokingly made suggestions about getting rid of Castro, and that one of them was to somehow get his beard off and mustache, and also the exploding cigar. Do you know anything of this? Was just a rumor, or actually it did occur?
Ron, let's find out. J.D. Connor?
I don't know. I'm not an expert on this sort of Fleming side of this. I've read about him, but I don't know the details of things like that.
Ron, thanks for calling into Radio Time. Sorry we can't get you
it's a great story.
A better answer. Yeah, it is a great story. So do you see this franchise continuing, J.D.?
Yeah, it's very healthy now. The people who run it, this is their baby, and this is what they really want to keep doing, and they seem to be able to get it together most of the time. Certainly the box office has never been bad for one of these films. And between this film and then eventually, I'm sure there'll be another video game. I'm surprised they didn't manage to get one out to go along with it. I think that James Bond will be back, it says at the end of the credits, and I'm sure he will.
And back in the form of Daniel Craig, you think?
Oh yeah, I'm sure. Unless something extra filmic happens to take Craig away from it, I don't think that they're going to want to move away from him for a little while.
Well, J.D., thank you for joining us.
No, thank you for having me.
And that's J.D. Connor. He's a professor of film and literature at Harvard University. We appreciate all your phone calls to Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out more about the program. Scotty Williams, the engineer for this week's edition of Radio Times with Al Banks. Devorah Lissick, Alan Tu, and Susan Greenbaum are the producers of Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. You're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia.